We're literally starting this show right in the middle of a conversation, and we have the naked mystery guest. Naked mystery guest, please introduce yourself.
Nobody wants to see me. Even my wife doesn't want to see me naked. Those days are long gone.
So what we are, everybody, yes, it's Wade, Tim, and Mark, and yeah. we're having a conversation. Mark, where are you?
I know. I have two walk-in closets in my condo, and I am in one of them because it gets me away from my wife. It gets me away from the woman who's currently cleaning the house. And plus, with all the clothes, I figure the audio will be better.
I see. That's very interesting. So you're using clothing as
it's brilliant.
Insulation.
It's brilliant.
As insulation. See, brilliant. Tim, thank you.
What's most interesting about this conversation before is that Mark's naked days are over, which means he had naked days.
Yeah.
I didn't have any naked days. That's crazy. Dude, Wade got me up to speed on some Hollywood business yesterday, and I just felt like the three of us had to have a conversation about this in the wake of the Golden Globes, which just happened this past Sunday.
Yeah.
Which were awful, you know, in my opinion, for a bunch of reasons. Not the nominees or wins, I should say. The various different folks who won in various different categories are interesting, but that's not what I wanted to talk about. I want to talk about what Wade told me about the organization that used to own the Golden Globes, Golden Globes Today, and the way this is all sort of shaped. So, you know, Wade.
So here's what a lot of people just were missing during the Golden Globes, because a lot of people are going up and saying, oh, I want to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press. There is no such thing as the Hollywood Foreign Press anymore. The HFPA, which was the organization that stood up the Golden Globes, right? Much like the AMPAS, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, stands up the Oscars, the Academy Awards. That organization has ceased to exist. It was dissolved last year. The organization went bankrupt. They've been embezzling, and it's been an illicit organization for years.
Marvel history.
That wonderful, very scary story of where we both wrote separate letters to the LA Times lambasting the Globes by weird random coincidence in a county of 10 million people. They put our two letters right next to each other in the Times. And that same, the next morning, the same guy from the Hollywood Foreign Press called both of us on our home phones to harass us. It was the most, it's like the CIA wouldn't do that.
He called me first. And unreal. The tenor of the conversation was, why did you write that? Right. And I told him why I wrote it and whatever he said. And then I believe I called you immediately after and I said, wait, did you just get a call from somebody at the Hollywood Foreign Press? And you said, no. And then your phone rang.
And then within like 5 minutes, the phone rang. It was the creep. I swear it was like living behind the Iron Curtain. I felt like the Stasi was looking at me. It was a creepy whole deal. And Tim and I have been longtime members of the IPA, the International Press Academy, which started as an alternative to the Golden Globes by Mirjana von Blarikam, who is a former Hollywood Foreign Press president, who was booted in a really nasty little political dust up, you know, like what, 15, 16 years?
Oh, longer, but yes, it was this. Yes, that was ugly.
Ugly. So Mirjana, out of kind of revenge, decided to stand up her own new organization and, you know, the International Press Academy and the Golden Satellites. And we've been members of that since the inception. And that's never really fully competed, but I think Mirjana...
It's still around.
Still there. Golden Satellites still has its awards show every year. In any case, so what's interesting now is that these Golden Globes, this is a total new organization. This is a new organization. The Golden Globes critics, I think, is what they call themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They bought all of... And this is where it gets really weird. So Penske, the Penske organization, nobody realizes all the trades are owned by the same people. Penske... Mm-hmm. Who's the heir of the racing Penske family. He owns Daily Variety, Hollywood Reporter, IndieWire, and Deadline. He owns all four of them. So that's basically, excluding the rap, that's like a monopoly on all the entertainment trade.
When I was in graduate school, all of that would have been illegal. From the 30s until the 90s, all of that would have been illegal.
And in January of last year, he joined with some kind of a hedge fund or investment operation, and they bought Dick Clark Productions. And then in June of last year,
because Dick Clark Productions was in trouble.
Yeah, because Dick Clark Productions was in trouble, minus the Golden Globes and all the other awards shows tanking. And, you know, New Year's Rockin' Eve without Dick Clark and with lots of, you know, drunk news people. boy, was that embarrassing. They were in trouble. So Penske bought them. And then through Dick Clark Productions, Penske has now acquired the Golden Globes in June of last year. And around about September, they basically let all the previous Golden Globe members know, look, if you want to be part of this new organization, here's the deal. You're going to take a $75,000 a year stipend. It's no longer a nonprofit. It is now a for-profit operation. This is a job. You will take $75,000 to vote, and you will not pull all that stuff that you used to pull with celebrities. No more photo ops, no more swag, no more none of the rest of that stuff. This is now a job. If you don't want to do that, then we will pay you $200,000+ and you can hit the road and we'll never see you again.
Now we know this because we have a very good friend, Wade and I.
This was all reported.
Okay, yeah.
It was reported. This is public knowledge. It just was not heavily reported for some strange reason. Maybe because the trades are owned by the same organization.
So this is
why independent people like us are useful occasionally. So this now is the new operation, and that all happened around about September, which basically gives you like, okay, they got to get their, you know, they invited 200 and some new members. We don't know who these people are. We don't know what the criterion is. We don't know anything about them. We have no idea what the new Golden Globes press organization represents. Like, we know the New York Film Critics Circle represents critics in New York. We know who they are. We know their outlets.
Yeah.
You know, it's Time, Newsweek, New York, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, right? We understand that.
At LAFCA, and you can go to our website and we're standing there in a bunch of badly lit photographs.
You know, LAFCA, we get it. Same deal in LA. All the other regionals. National Society of Film Critics. Well, you look at their names. They're culled from New York. Some people are culled from LAFCA. They're culled from various places. The Critics' Choice Association, which all three of us are members of as well. Well, those are broadcast people. They're not even critics necessarily. Many are, but not all are. They are broadcast journalists who work in the entertainment space. Many of them critics. And they're from all over the country. So, I mean, all these groups have, they're transparent, they have a profile, and almost all of them are nonprofits. The Golden Globes is now a for-profit operation with conflicts of interest galore. It may be less ethical than the organization that's
the Hollywood Foreign Press was.
It may be.
How could it not be?
It you know, so
it's like that snake that eats its own tail.
It's a very, very strange situation. But they were so desperate to get those ad dollars in the coffers to just make sure that, you know, the damage that was done during COVID, that we're, you know, it's like we cannot let this year go by. There's not a reorganization year. So from like September to December, like in an 8-week period, they had to get this new membership together, a new voting process together. They had to get their nominations together, and they had to start planning a show. And that's why Joe Coy wasn't hired until like 10 days before the show aired. CBS came in, picked it up from NBC. CBS has no history of doing this. You know, they've done the Tonys and a few other things, but I mean, this is like all thrown together so quickly. So everyone understands these awards shows. Mark, when do you start planning, say, an awards show for television as a TV producer person? On what day do you begin planning the next year's awards show?
The day after that year's awards show ends.
Exactly.
Always. Wait, before we, $75K, right? And then there was another sort of buyout thing, the 250.
Like 200, 200, 220, 250. It wasn't 250. It might have been 220. It might be around 200. But it's somewhere, it's in excess of $200,000 to just walk away. Walk away from the organization.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm almost sure that this scene happened in The Godfather Part 3. I'm almost certain this exact scenario was in that movie. So to summarize, Hollywood Foreign Press no longer exists. Gone.
And that's why everybody who was going up there and thanking the Hollywood Foreign Press because their publicists either didn't know or didn't school them, that big mistake.
Which is why Robert Downey Jr. said,
he went up and said, you changed your game and you changed your name. You know, it was a good little rhyme, good little rap that he went up there with, and it was prepared and it was accurate. And because he's a smart guy, he's on top of it. But the others weren't necessarily. And I thought that was interesting. He went up and he tried to legitimize the award by distinguishing in that moment, saying this is not like what it used to be. And I think that was a very astute thing and a welcome thing. But the question for us is, as observers, what is it now? I know what it used to be, and what it used to be was crooked and corrupt and a sleazy kind of a shell game that everybody in town knew, and very few people. Everybody went up there and they reluctantly accepted their awards, and they knew that it was like, you know, whatever. I have to go through the motions. A lot of those people this year, they kind of still look like they didn't want to be there and that they really were going through the motions. Like I was saying to some people, I said, Christopher Nolan and his wife, if you looked at them, those very proper, distinguished, professional British people, they looked like they were trapped in a room with preschoolers, except they were drunk preschoolers. Like if you were trapped in a preschool room with drunk preschoolers, that's the look on your face.
Well, because the previous Golden Globes, it was a joke that everybody bought into because it was good for business.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So now the Golden Globes is still good for business. But the thing is that in order to legitimize itself, as you say, people have to have some sense of where these members come from. They can make it up. It could be people who live in Botswana, whatever it is. But as long as people feel as if the members aren't just these random people taking swag, I think if they can create that thing where, oh, I understand where these members come from. They are critics who do this or critics who come from that. Then I feel like you'll get a sense of what the organization is about. Because as you say, people know what the CCAs are. People know what LAFC is. People know what the New York Film Critics Circle is. People get it. So at least there's some foundation there. But with the Golden Globes still, see, it used to be with the Golden Globes, it was 97 crooked people. Right. That made up the Golden Globes. Now it's 300 of what? If they can define what, that would help the Golden Globes next level.
If it's 70K, so what does that mean to become a member of the Golden Globes? Does that mean you've been hired by the Golden Globes? You know, I mean, what does that mean? Do I work for you now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's not answered. I think technically this would be considered an honorarium or a stipend. If we have to put some kind of a legal term to it, that's what I think they would probably call it. I don't think how is this on your taxes? You get a 1099, you get a W-2, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Those kind of hair splitting distinctions between an independent contractor and an employee. And
in the world of journalism, this still all matters. There is something called journalistic ethics. Yeah. And you know, it's a fine line that we all walk every year this time. And, you know, when we get the big books and all this kind of stuff, but a flat out 75K. I don't know. Not that I want to take a cent of that money out of anybody's pocket. Those journalists, I can promise you need that dough.
The thing is that it's not even just a 75K. According to the LA Times, they also get medical and dental benefits, and they get vacation bonuses. So I don't know what those bonuses are based on. All I know is that these
vacation members, from what?
I don't know. Well, here's the thing: that they if you're a member of the New Globes, you get to vote on nominations and winners. You have to write content for the organization's website, organize and help put on the show. And there is some moderate, probably BS, garbage responsibilities involved. You have to earn your 75. But you know what? If they want to hire me to do it, I'll do that. I'll do it all day long.
That sounds like
right now. I'll do anything.
Much of what you just said are things that, to one extent or another, someone and many members of LAFCA are involved in as we prepare to do the thing that we do. Many of us are writing this and writing that, and many of us, I mean, not just the, you know, the people on the board are doing all kinds of things to make that happen. Now, again, would be perfectly happy for all of those people to be getting paid to do all that work because it's work. Yeah. And to the extent that we at LAFCA can, in fact, write and post things on that lab, and we do, or we write things someplace that we post at the lab. I would love to, you know, that would be great. But I'm not sure. I just don't know, man. What is an organization that does that? What is that? Interesting.
Yeah, it really is a very strange thing, and I don't know what to make of it. I'm not comfortable with the conflict of interest that it represents. You know, I even if Penske is kind of putting, even if they're, you know, only 50% owners or 49% owners or whatever it is that they kind of put Dick Clark Productions between them and the awards, it's still, there are a lot of questions. There are a lot of unresolved questions. This all happened so quickly with Penske and Dick Clark, and then 6 months later, you know, the purchase of the Globes, and then, you know, 3-4 months later, the throwing the show together, and here we are, you know, literally 12 months after Penske acquired Dick Clark Productions, and we just had a show that everyone hated. It was horrible. Mm. It was badly done. Mark, you, I mean, your comments were hilarious to me. share your assessment of it.
Well, as somebody who is a TV show producer, I'm always a little more sympathetic. I liken the show to an 88-mile-an-hour fastball when the count is 3-0, meaning that all you have to do is get the pitch over the plate. Just get it over the plate, because you don't want to walk the batter. And they basically got the pitch over the plate. Was it a great fastball? Was it 102-mile-an-hour Aroldis Chapman fastball? No. It was some lame 45-year-old pitcher who was on his way out fastball, but the guy got it over the plate. And what can you say? The ratings were up 50% from last year, which is a good start.
But they couldn't have been worse.
They could be worse. Look at the Oscars.
10 million viewers is 10 million viewers. We are, guys. 10 million is 10 million. Of course, that's all that people were there. And we have to talk about Taylor. Five of that 10 was there to see Taylor.
Yes. And a lot of, and look, let's face it, I know a lot of people who don't care what the brand of the group is. It's just like, well, I like movies and I want to watch people, you know, I want to see acceptance speeches and awards. I said, but don't you care who gives the awards? Don't you care what the award means? Nah, I just want to see a red carpet.
Most people really don't. Most people want to see the red carpet show. They want to see which actress has had work done and what they're wearing. That's really all they care about.
So if the awards are voted by like a star chamber of Satanists who are like spilling goat's blood on the floor while they're voting, like you wouldn't care. Like it just No, not really. I just want to see people go up and accept awards. I mean, truly, a lot of the people watching, that's why they're watching. They don't care. They don't know what the Academy is. They don't know what the goal. They don't know who's voting. They don't know what the tone. They don't know the difference between the American Music Awards and the Grammys. They don't care. They just want.
And by the way,
they want to see stars.
And by the way, why should they? If you live in Crib Death, Iowa, and you got nothing going on in your life, and you see these beautiful people, right, in their beautiful gowns and beautiful tuxedos, it's a big energy show. It's got beautiful people. It's got awards. It's got acceptance speeches. It's got fun and energy and laughs. Why the hell not? Why wouldn't you want to watch it?
Yeah, perhaps a good deal of this is sort of like inside the beltway chit chat. But look, I do know this. I've got so many varieties in there right now. A stack of varieties from the last, I don't know, whatever, 3 months now.
It's awful.
It's ridiculous. Oh,
and that's because of the CCAs that we get those, by the way. You know that, right?
Yeah. It's a whole
because we're members.
We're all members, and we get the friends. Yeah. And if you look inside those varieties, up until the region, you have plenty of Golden Globes ads. Plenty of Golden Globes, you know. Not just ads, but content. And when you start to draw that circle again, you know, Penske, the ownership, all of those varieties, the Golden Globes, the ads inside the Golden Globes. Dude, I'm telling you, 30 years ago, in the middle 80s, most of this would have been illegal. And somebody would have been looking at jail time. The fair use rules and all kinds of owned and operated rules came into play, which sort of disaggregated all of that, who can own what and how many of which in what city, and all of these kind of things. It was all very complicated. But what we've got now is this bit of a mess. And you're right, Mark. Who cares? We three knuckleheads sitting here ranting and raving.
But what's interesting when you talk about conflict of interest is Eldridge Industries, which is the Uber umbrella company that owns the Golden Globes. They own Dick Clark Productions, right? And they also own the Hollywood Reporter and Variety. And as Wade was saying, they also, by the way, have a piece of 824.
the movie studio. Yeah,
which is fascinating because A24 had 10 nominations in the film categories this year. Is that because Eldridge Industries, which owns the Golden Globes, which owns Dick Clark Productions, which owns the Hollywood Reporter and Variety, also owns a production company? That would be more troublesome to me than anything else.
Well, it just became more troublesome. It just made it more troublesome. It's something that I think needs to be reported on, at least within the industry. Yeah, out there in crib death, maybe not.
It's going to be a very interesting trajectory between now and 2028, which is when the 100th Oscars ceremony will take place. So we are now 4 years away from that. And the Academy has exercised an option to abandon its contract with ABC early. And that's been going on since, gee whiz, what, the 80s? Mm. Late 70s? I mean, it's been, you know, they have been with ABC solid for like over 40 years. It's amazing. And a lot of the problems that we have with the Academy Awards telecast have to do with the fact that ABC swings a big bat. They can veto Johnny Carson. They can veto anybody, which they did for years. They can veto anybody as a host who doesn't meet with, you know, ABC brass's metrics.
Because Johnny was on NBC, so that was a network rivalry thing.
That's why Jimmy Kimmel is a no-brainer. It's on ABC. He's in-house. So, ABC swings a big bat. How many ads they sell, what they sell the ads for. It was ABC who tried to get them to create that new category that didn't fly, that, you know, biggest blockbuster category. I mean, which did the
Globes do and everybody loves. It's just so funny.
Stupid category. I mean, what does it even mean? What does it mean?
Here's what it means. It means that Taylor Swift shows up to the Golden Globes. That's what it means. She got nominated in that category.
Here's the other thing that you know, this is why and this could not come at a worse time. Did you guys all see the ESPN thing that just blew up a few hours ago?
Yes. Okay. Oh,
that's really interesting. There are like 35 Emmy Awards that have been won over the past 14 years by ESPN, which must now be returned because an investigation by the TV Academy determined that ESPN for about 14 years was putting fake names up as nominees so that they could then get the Emmy Award and in the name of a person who doesn't exist, re-engrave it and hand it to on-air talent who was not eligible to even win the Emmy in the first place.
This is just insane.
This is madness.
That's crazy.
That's not even just, oh, I made a mistake. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand the rules about campaigning. You know, I mean, that's not like some, you could interpret the fine print. No, that is just straight up fraud.
Yeah.
That is just straight up illicit fraud.
And for no good reason. I mean, for pure, what, vanity? Vanity? What's
real? It's insane. It's insane. So all of that leaves an incredibly bad taste in people's mouths about these awards shows to begin with. It's suddenly you're thinking, OK, so it's not now it's just completely craven on a level that makes the whole thing feel dirty.
So if the Academy bolts ABC, it looks like they will simply the Academy
likely become a streaming show. Which will obviously be on some streaming platform, maybe several streaming platforms, as well as maybe another network. But what it does is it gives them control over the advertising. It gives them control over the length of the show, gives them more control over the production of the show. They don't have ABC sticking its nose in there every 10 minutes and saying, we need something to please this advertiser. We need something to please the young kids. Well, this is our key demo. Our advertisers want the youth demo. So you got to hire a host who appeals to the youth. Like ABC meddling in the show is part of what the problem has always been. Because ABC, yes, they want the advertising dollars. But as we all know, there are a lot of ways to slice up advertising dollars. Just because ABC says the youth demo is what their advertisers want, well, that doesn't mean much. I mean, if you have, let's say, you know, would you rather have 30 million people over the age of 50 watching or 10 million people between 20 and 25?
I mean, they'd rather have 10 million people over the age of 10 million people because in their mind, the 10 million. Yes. Yeah.
ABC
would, because those 10 million
would.
No, I think the Academy wants, at this point, they're sort of at a precipice a little bit, right? They're like at an inflection point in their existence as they come up towards their 100th anniversary. Yeah. I think they want sheer raw numbers. They want to be able to, if it's streaming, which, by the way, would be a huge come down for the Oscars, but I understand why they'd want to do it. Look at how Netflix cooks their numbers. Oh my God, some crap ass show got 150 billion minutes worth of views, whatever garbage that means, right? Yeah. If the Academy can get in on that, they can make this case that the Academy is relevant again, right?
The Academy needs two things. And they think they need three things, and the third thing they don't really need. But so let me say this. Here's what they need. They need legitimacy. Right. They need to say we represent an institution that is meaningful in the culture. 30 million people watched us. We are important. We matter. Our awards matter. Getting an Oscar matters. It's meaningful. It's meaningful to talent. It's meaningful to audiences. It's meaningful. They need that. They need to be relevant. They need to be legitimate. They also need money. They need money to run the organization. It costs a lot of money. That building costs money. We've all seen it. The library costs money. Their archives down. I mean, you know, there are what, three or four buildings that the Academy operates here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Right. There's the one in Hollywood. There's the main headquarters in Beverly Hills, the library in Beverly Hills, and then, you know, whatever warehouse they have their archives in that we went to that one time when we gave them the LAFCA archive, right? So those are the four main buildings, and that's a lot to operate.
And nobody pays dues to the Academy, right? The members don't pay dues. I don't think they do.
I don't know if they do or not. They can certainly all afford to, but it wouldn't be about a drop in the bucket. I mean, you know, 5,000 people paying $150 that'll pay your rent for like a month on that building. So the Oscar show funds that organization for the whole year. And I've always said that's a really fragile thing. Like, you look at what happened to the California economy. California's economy has been so weighted heavily toward high earning taxpayers that when they have a bad stock year, the whole state gets sick. And it's the same thing with the Academy. If those ad dollars from that one night significantly drop, they're not making money the rest of the year. That impact, that's all, that's it. They're literally earning their entire year in one night. And that's dangerous. You gotta diversify how you earn money. So they have to figure out how to make money throughout the year. They can't just all rely on that one pack of ad dollars. But
well, they do get member dues, by the way. They do get member dues. Yes, they have to pay member dues. In 2018, the member dues went up to $450 a year.
Gee whiz. Wow.
Can Tom Hanks afford that?
Well, I guess they'll be all right. But it's interesting. So basically what they're going to do is they're going to Taylor Swift the show, get the middleman out. And then you bring in a crew of people to sell advertising, I guess, or whatever they would be doing. And then all that money is just their money.
And they can be more flexible about those ad dollars. So, I mean, it'll be much more interest. It'll be interesting to see how they manage that. But I think if they get a large audience, if you can push back to 30 million people, let's say if they can get back to 30 million people, they don't even need to get back to the 40. Just get back into the mid 20s to start. If you can get back to 25, 30 million people watching that show, I don't care what age they are. I don't care if those are 30 million people who are over the age of 60. Sell them Geritol. Sell them vitamin supplements. You are going to make somebody is going to buy ads for those people. Yeah. Somebody wants to hit that. They have disposable income. So what I'm saying is that's money to somebody. It just is. You can make that work. And so that's the one thing they need money and they need legitimacy. The other thing that they think they need, but they don't really need, is to erase criticism. They are scared of, you know, social media is going to blow up and there's going to be like a hashtag, you know, like Oscar so white is going to become Oscars so something else. Oscars not disabled enough. Oscars, you know, like too many, not enough horror films. I mean, that could go, they're terrified that could go viral. They need to not be. There are legitimate criticisms and then there are trolls. And some things have meaning to artists and to audiences. And some things don't, it's just people rambling on social media and it doesn't have a footprint. and they need to not be afraid of a handful of trolls on social media saying things about the Oscars that nobody really cares about. But they're terrified of that. So they need to sort of distinguish between the noise that matters and the noise that doesn't matter. And the noise that does matter typically matters regardless of what's happening on social media. So if they just write off social media entirely and go with the old adage that there's no such thing as bad publicity, they'll be fine. So do away with that. Make your money, legitimize the show, bring an audience back. I think then the future is bright, but they have got to make, they're still on the precipice. It's still a new academy.
Well, for the third point, which I agree with, the smartest thing that they could do, at least would make me laugh, is to hire Kevin Hart as their very first host.
You know what? I agree. I totally agree. Kevin Hart got shafted. That was a dumb, scaredy. That's exactly what I'm talking about. They were scared. Social media went a little nuts on Kevin Hart and they got scared. Why? Kevin Hart packs stadiums. Have you seen how he packs stadiums?
Yeah.
Kevin Hart is an amazing entrepreneur, entertainer, personality. He kills it. You could only be so lucky as to get Kevin Hart. I mean, bring Kevin Hart and suddenly that show blows up. Are there going to be like maybe a million people who won't watch because they're pissed off at Kevin Hart forever? Yeah, so what? Who cares? I mean, more people will come than not. Kevin Hart, that's a dream.
The broad notion I completely agree with. I do have a desire, though, for these shows to move away from the necessity to be funny, to be comedy forward. We talk about the Golden Globes and the writing and how Joy threw his writers under the bus. The fact of the matter, that entire show was badly written. All of his jokes were badly written. Yeah. But the whole show was badly written.
The whole show was and I agree with you. I think what we would all like to see, what it used to be, you know, if you go back to the Bob Hope days, they weren't all, not everybody had to be funny.
Yeah.
Bob, the reason you hired Bob Hope was so that nobody else had the burden of having to try to be funny. Bob Hope brought the funny.
Yeah.
So everybody else could just bring the
elegance and sophistication. The David Niven. Give me David Niven just standing there with that little mustache and looking good in that tux. And you know what? I go back and I say that. David Niven was actually very funny.
Oh, very funny.
And very dry, very funny.
Very dry. Yeah. So it's not like he wasn't funny, but I don't think anybody wrote David any jokes. I'm almost certain nobody wrote David any jokes.
No. Kevin Hart would bring the funny, and then nobody else has to be funny. And then what you do is let Kevin Hart be the new Billy Crystal. Let him just come on and just do his Kevin Hart thing. You know, I'm going to say, I know he's controversial. I don't care. I think controversy plays. If you can get Dave Chappelle to just tame his language enough and to do
if it's streaming,
Dave Chappelle brings an audience as well. If Ricky Gervais could bring an audience to the Globes and he did, Dave Chappelle could bring an. I wouldn't say Ricky Gervais for the Oscars. That matchup doesn't make any sense. But I could see Dave Chappelle doing it because he's Kevin Hart's buddy too, and he's joked about it. So I mean, you bring those two on. I think then you are establishing something that is sustainable.
My fear for the Oscars, if they go to streaming, is twofold. One is, where does it wind up? Does it wind up on the AMPAS website? Does it wind up on, does Netflix stream it live? Whatever, does ABC.com stream it live?
They'll figure it out.
The other fear I have is that now that the...
Wait, hold that thought. Jerry Seinfeld should have hosted the Oscars a million years ago. I've always thought Seinfeld would have been a terrific Oscars host. Just saying.
In my mind, somehow, he did host Oscars. I can almost see it. I don't know. I guess that's just something I made up.
Didn't happen.
That would be great, though. And the other fear I have is that now that the Academy feels untethered from ABC and all their strictures, that they're going to potentially lean into the worst impulses that bore people like me who watch these shows, which is there's an award for every category. There's no time on acceptance speeches. People can say whatever they want and go on forever. It could be a 5-hour show as long as everybody gets their ass kissed. I really hope it's not that.
It does. It won't be, because what they want to do is they want to bring the running time of the show down. And what no one talks about is the show is not too seriously. You compare Oscar shows in the past to you know, these ones that go to 4+ hours. It's not like people are talking longer. It's not like there are more categories. It's not that the show has become longer. It's that ABC keeps insisting on more and more ad spots. That's what drives the show open. So, you know, there were Oscar shows that came in at like 2 hours and 40 minutes because they weren't added up to the gills. If you go to streaming and you make this very, very judicious and you say, look, you're going to have to pay more for your ad spot, but just so you understand, it's an ad spot people will notice because it's going to be one of only a few spots.
Yeah, maybe your Super Bowl, you make it like Super Bowl ads.
There you go.
Your Super Bowl. Yeah.
Then you can manage the time and you can manage the money. And it becomes, you know, again, it's a little bit of a roll of the dice. But if they can get this in order in time for that very, very spectacular 100th anniversary, because you cannot screw up 2028. You've got 4 years to get that in order. Okay, you can't screw that up, or you're done. You're finished.
Well, my biggie, I agree with Mark 100%. You got to shut a lot of people up. So generally speaking, yes, you're David, you Bob Hope, you Kevin Hart. It the only person who's going to be funny in terms of a joke written for them will be that host of that show. Everybody else is going to walk up to that podium and say the nominees are. And the Oscar goes to, and pretty much nothing else, more or less, nothing else. Some people are naturally funny, and will do that. But I would, if I were the god producer of the Academy Awards, I would look at every fucking word of that script,
yeah,
and every joke, and this is for sure, and this would be for the host too. Everything and everybody related to this show is fabulous. All the movies are wonderful. All the actors are exquisite. Even the politics. If you want to do politics, the politics are going to be positive. And we're going to be for, and we're going to love everything. If you got a bug up your ass about anything, talk about it before the show or after the show. Everything about this show is going to be beautiful. And somebody should have told Joy that. All the movies are great, dude. All the filmmakers are fabulous, and all the actors are beautiful. I don't know who didn't put that in your inbox, but somebody should have told you.
Yeah. Oh, he's on his apology tour for the last couple of days because you don't throw your writers under the bus ever for any reason. Nobody cares that you and the writers met for the first time the day before the show, right? There are monologue writers. I watch Stephen Colbert every night. I think their monologue is so strong. And by the way, half their staff is like young women. It's fantastic. And it's so damn funny. They come up with an amazing 10-minute monologue every night. Yep. Okay. You guys, Joe Coy and your three writers, you had a huge target that you could hit. And somehow you managed to not even hit it.
Yeah. Missed the whole target.
Missed it completely. But he was trying to be Ricky Gervais. That's what it was. There was the expectation, oh, if you do the Golden Globes, you got to be Ricky Gervais. No, man. Do it. Do your own thing. Do your own deal. But there was, you know, again, they threw this thing together in a matter of weeks.
And I've seen Joy's show. I reviewed that movie that he did not too terribly long ago for film. Easter Sunday. You know, so the whole Filipino culture. You're funny movie. You've been made 1,000 times. Here's the thing about his actual routine. All of the human's actual routine is self-deprecating. He's talking about himself, his family, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's his stick. That's his jokes. His jokes have never been about poking and prodding and kicking and controversy and all of that. Why? And I don't know, man. It seems to me that even as a comedian, you got to have a gut, right? Don't you got a gut? Don't you got a gut that tells you, hey, man, I just met you guys, but this is not my funny.
They were desperate. They went to everybody. Everybody said, no, the show was going to happen in a matter of days. They needed somebody. And I guess he was the guy that picked up the phone.
You know what? I mean, money talks. Well, let's move on and see where all of this goes in the next few weeks. We've had a ton of obits, and we got to get to some DVDs here and Blu-rays. Mark, you're going to stick around for the DVD and the Blu-ray conversation and weigh in.
You don't have to do that, but you got to weigh in on the obits. The dead require your commentary.
Okay, you know what? I will stick around for the obits.
Since we were up last year, a ton of people have died. End of 23, beginning of 20. Here's who we lost. We lost Marty Croft at 86. We lost Andre Brower, far too young. We lost Tommy Smothers, God bless him. We lost Shecky Green, one of the last of the Borscht Belt comics. I think we're only down to three now, including Woody Allen and Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
We lost Morris Hines.
Yeah,
who's now dancing up a storm with his brother in the Great Yonder. We lost Tom Wilkinson, and we lost Glynis Johns at age 100. Mrs. Banks from Mary Poppins.
All of those are a little bit surprising, but I guess Tom Wilkinson, that was the one that made me. I was like, what? You know, that one, and I don't know why that one, but Tom was the one. I was like, that just doesn't make any sense. But he was what, clocking 80?
He was like late 70s.
He was 75. He was 75.
Mid-70s, yeah.
He came to us so late, in my mind. I got about 25 years of Tom. Yeah, and then he was just, I know he was on stage and all that stuff for so many years, but he came to us so late that, I don't know, it's just, it's not one of those guys. I can't think of any Tom Wilkinson from when he's 20.
Yeah.
No, you know what? To me, he's like one of the, like, Jonathan Pryce types, where he's this English actor who everybody loves. He does everything. He's been there for as long as we've been alive. He's always good, and he's just a mainstay. He's just one of those little.
He was solid. He was so solid. And yeah, I mean, you know, I remember the year that Lafka voted for In the Bedroom as Best Picture. Well, that was the year of Mulholland Drive, which my wife was, you know, an executive on. And I didn't vote for Mulholland Drive. I voted for In the Bedroom because I loved In the Bedroom. I thought it was amazing. And Todd Field killed it with that film. That was his directing debut. It was unbelievable. And Wilkinson is the soul of that movie. I mean, you latch yourself onto him and you ride through that movie.
Yeah, man.
The other one that bothered me was Andre Brower. And Andre Brower bothered me because I always thought he should have been bigger. He should have been a movie star. He should have won awards. He was so commanding and so great. And somehow his career was never as big as I was hoping it would be.
Even though nobody else liked it, I thought it was one of the best films of last year, not last year, but the year before. She Said, which, you know, was all about the Harvey Weinstein thing. Man, Andre Brower is just, he is phenomenal in that film. Phenomenal. And
Andre, who bizarrely is like a year younger than me, Andre was born in 62 out of Chicago. Interesting, him and Shecky both out of Chicago. I love that. Andre, in 89, I guess it was, maybe 90, Glory, right? So him and Denzel and Morgan, just all these brothers are in this movie. And there are two or three movies over the course of the last 40 years that gave us a whole lot of people. A Soldier Story was one of them. That's the one that actually gave us Denzel. Howard Rollins, Robert Townsend, and then the next one was Glory. That just handed us all of these actors, these, you know, African-American actors that for the next, almost 40 years, 35, 40 years, would just sort of like be this presence in all these. March Wright, Andre should have been a movie star. He should have been a movie star. Now, he happened to have come up in that time when we had kind of gone back to good looking movie stars, you know, real good looking movie stars. And Andre had an everyday guy. So in the early 70s, when Dustin and Jag and all those guys, if Andre would have been there, he would have been a movie star. Yeah, that's, you know, but there you go.
But, you know, he was asked about why he turned down so many. He turned down a lot of work, and he was asked about it. And he said, because I didn't want to sacrifice family time for it.
Yeah.
You know, he's got kids. He wanted, it turned out to be the right choice because he died prematurely, and he was able to spend more time raising his kids and with his family. And as sad as that loss is, I can't help but respect it. By the same token, you know, just putting some, so we don't drag this all out too far. Glynis Johns, 100 years old, lived a good life. We all know her from Mary Poppins. But let me tell you something. If you watch the old movie Miranda, where she plays a mermaid, she is the sexiest mermaid the movies have ever had. Yeah. Glynis Johns kills it in that film. And we forget she sings that the original version of Send in the Clowns that just it tears your heart out. It absolutely rips your heart out. So she did Sondheim right. Morris Hines, not known as a movie actor, really a Broadway guy. But the one performance that he did with Gregory as brothers, basically in the Cotton Club, never got the credit that it deserved. Until like a year and a half ago when Coppola released the director's cut of The Cotton Club, which restored that story, because that became a secondary story to the Richard Gere narrative in the cut that was released theatrically. And it was never supposed to be. It was supposed to be a balance between that white jazz trumpeter and these two black dancers. It was supposed to be like the, you know, looking at these two different worlds in this one club through these two parallel stories. It was supposed to be balanced. Coppola restored that balance. And I'll tell you, you know who wins in that cut is Morris. He is the heart and soul of that relationship, because Gregory is kind of, he wants to be a star and Morris wants family. Mm. And it is such a beautiful performance. He's not known as a movie actor, but he slays it in that cut. And I'm so glad that that performance has now been restored and that his place in movie history is restored. And then lastly, Tommy Smothers. What can Smothers? I mean, come on. Just one of the great comedy talents of all time.
With Tommy Smothers and Shecky Green, you're starting to see some of these people who we grew up on. And we had Shecky's a little before, I think, our time. Shecky was a stand-up comic in the 50s, one of the great Vegas acts. It was Shecky. It was Don Rickles. It was Buddy Hackett. All those guys in the 70s play in Vegas all the time. It really creating what the Vegas stand-up comedy performance act could be, which has now been taken over by all the Carrot Tops and the Seinfelds and the whatevers. It really started with Shecky. So him and Tommy Smothers, these are people who laid the groundwork for the comics that we love today and who continue to love today.
As I've said many times, the two great strains of American comedy both come out of tragedy and oppression. It's the Jewish comedy and the black comedy. And both of those things, they came out of originally vaudeville and the Chitlin circuit. And then they went to clubs, the Borscht Belt clubs up in the Catskills and the inner city clubs.
Chicago,
Philadelphia, New York and L.A. And in the 50s, when television came around, you had the Sheckies and the Bill Cosbys and all these comics coming out of those clubs in the inner city and the Catskills and getting on TV and going on The Tonight Show and going on all these variety shows. And suddenly what was previously a regional and an ethnic comedy tradition went national. It blew up through television. And that's how we get those two great comedy strains today. I mean, that's how we got Jerry Lewis. It's how we wound up getting Richard Pryor. That's where it all came from. So, Shecky was a huge part of that.
Yeah, Shecky, born in Chicago, died in Vegas. That is perfectly circular. That is just perfect. Love it.
Well, let's get into some Blu-rays here. I'm going to hit a bunch of Warner Archive stuff real fast. These are all relatively recent-ish movies, and by recent, I mean that they're during our lifetimes.
You're sticking around, Mark.
Wait, hang on. Yeah. Be honest. How long will this take?
I don't know.
An hour, 20 minutes?
About an hour.
An hour?
Yeah.
F that. I'm leaving.
Okay. All right. Well,
don't stop the recording. Let me tell you something. Sir. I have a very, very busy life. I'm unemployed. I do nothing. That's my life.
Okay.
And yet somehow, I don't want to see you and hear you for an hour talking about Blu-rays that no one will ever buy or rent.
I just want everyone to know that the name you attach to yourself here is to your track is Rufus Roughcut.
Yes,
just genius. That's absolutely hilarious. All right, Rufus, we'll see you. All right, guys,
take care. Weekend.
All right,
you too. Bye, guys.
Bye, everyone.
All right, Tim, we got a bunch of, here's a bunch of stuff. So I'm going to roll through this. First of all, Before the Night, which is the Julian Schnabel film with Javier Bardem. I'm just up and down on Schnabel.
Diving Bell of the Butterfly, that's my Schnabel, and then I'm done.
Before Night Falls, which is, basically the story of the Cuban poet Ronaldo Arenas and how he was imprisoned and his books were banned and all this stuff and his experience. And it's a very interesting story. I just don't know that it sustains me through the whole movie. But nonetheless, Bardem is great in it. That's out on Blu-ray. Saving Grace, in which Brenda Bleffin and Craig Ferguson grow some weed and sell it. And it's kind of funny. They, you know, turn her greenhouse into a pot.
Those little movies used to be all I don't know what. There's a minute in the middle 90s when those little movies, particularly the ones with British people, Irish people, whatever, they were all the rich. I love those back in the day. That one's cute.
That's cute. Mad City with Hoffman and Travolta. What a odd thing this was. I mean, Costa Gavras directed this, and I've done a DVD commentary with Costa Gavras, who's a wonderful man. This feels like just a for hire job. It's very strange mixing of talents, the director and the two actors. It's not as amazing as it should be. It's basically, it's a media. It's not a satire, but it's one of these movies about the excesses of media. Right. Hoffman is the TV reporter who becomes a hostage of Travolta, who's a very disturbed guy. It's the media circus that blows up, but it never quite kind of rises to the commentary that I think it wants to.
It wants to say something about something, but it's not sure what it wants to say about that something. And then it also doesn't want you to be mad at anybody. It doesn't want John Travolta to be the bad guy. There's no bad guys, but you know what? There's got to be a bad guy. Children have been taken hostage.
And speaking of great European directors doing strange American projects, next is Palmetto with Woody Harrelson and Elizabeth Shue. And that was directed by Volker Schlondorf.
Yeah.
Who is also a great director who here seems a little bit out of his depth with this very strange kind of caper gone wrong story. Doesn't really feel like what he should be doing, but some decent performances. And you know, Chloe Sevigny in an early young performance is fine too, but it didn't work for me.
Volker, he directed that movie version of the very popular now television The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes, he did.
That was Volker. There was a moment when these little movies, this Trigger Effect, there were a bunch of them. So, X number of days in the valley. What was it? Three days in the valley. It was like a thing for a moment there. Sure. So, started coming out. I guess Tarantino kind of launched it.
Yeah.
True Romance or something like that. And then for a while we had this little, these movies are not theatrical movies anymore. Now these are streaming movies.
The very unusual Rapa Nui, you know, Kevin Reynolds attached to the hip for many years to Kevin Costner. What parts of Costner's films Reynolds directed is always kind of a trivia question. How much of Dancing with Wolves was Reynolds and how much was Costner? How much of Waterworld was Reynolds and how much of, you know, all that?
Robin Hood, the whole shebang.
And so it's always an open question. Here, it's just straight up Kevin Reynolds. And there is stuff in this movie that is so good and there is stuff that is so embarrassingly like worst film of all time bad.
Yeah.
And it's so strange. It presumes to be an epic about the people on responsible for the sculptures on Easter Island. It's a little mystical. It's a little, I don't know. It just, at times it feels too much like Zardoz to me.
You don't have Sean Connery in that little red Speedo or whatever.
I felt like I was expecting Connery to show up at any moment and one of those Easter Island statues would just turn into the big stone head. I honestly thought.
I appreciate Esau, young Esau Morales, the role. And of course, Jason Scott Lee.
In Love and War with Sandra Bullock and Chris O'Donnell. This is basically a Richard Attenborough directed film, another European director, beautifully shot by Roger Pratt. But really, this is the story that is presumably the basis of A Farewell to Arms. So you've got Chris O'Donnell playing the young Hemingway and Sandra Bullock as the young nurse.
And, Agnes.
And I got to tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason why we have a Farewell to Arms and not just a straight diary of the events, because a Farewell to Arms is Hemingway making that otherwise mundane story really interesting.
Yeah.
If you're just going to tell me that story and not go with a Farewell to Arms, it's not that interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then lastly, on the new...
I did not buy Chris O'Donnell as a young Ernest Hemingway kid. Are you killing
me? No, there's no way. And then I gotta tell you, man, I've been waiting for this next one to come out on Blu-ray forever. Kenneth Branagh's Black and White: A Midwinter's Tale. This was written by Branagh and directed by Branagh. It's a little movie that he made in 1995. It's not considered like one of his great films. It should be, because it may actually still be my favorite of his movies. It is so insanely funny. This movie rips me to pieces. It's just a silly little black and white comedy about a group of actors who are going to put on a production of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And everything that goes on around it is just absolutely insane. It's a complete actor's indulgence, but it is a brilliant farce. It is so funny. And what it says about acting and big budget acting, and you know, when you take the little gig versus the big gig. And I mean, some of the jokes here just absolutely rip me to pieces. And some of it gets so heartfelt. I love this movie.
Yeah.
Midwinter's Tale is so brilliant.
And some great Jennifer Saunders and Joan Collins, late Joan Collins. Some really great old wonderful British actors pop
terrific
up.
And then we also have volume 2 of Looney Tune Collector's Choice. I'll just make this real quick. There's a bunch of great classic shorts here. You're going to want to get this, because there's no telling how long some of these things stay on Max. They may start mixing it up. But you get Brother Brat, which is super funny. Rabbit Rampage, also super funny. The Wacky Worm, total classic, and A Hick, A Slick, and A Chick is also priceless. So a lot of great stuff. Not really a lot of rhyme or reason as to why these were selected. You know, they kind of mix it up in a random way, but there's a lot of, I mean, you know, eventually you're going to want all the stuff. So go for it.
Yeah.
The older movies, we start with The Great Ziegfeld, which won Best Picture, one of the earliest Best Picture winners of the Academy Awards, with William Powell as Flo Ziegfeld. This is an amazing transfer and an amazing movie, and they just don't make them like this anymore.
Miranda Lori is so cute. Just ridiculous. 1930 what?
Gosh,
1936.
Yeah. One of the very, very first. I mean, you know, priceless. I mean, it's weird thinking that this movie is almost 90 years old.
Yeah, man.
But it's it really is. This is just one of those first great biopics, and it's magnificent, and it's a wonderful transfer. You should get it on Blu-ray and treasure it. Greta Garbo and Anna Christie. I've got a Garbo bio sitting next to my bed that I need to start. But here's the thing about Anna Christie. This is where you understand. This is one of those very early silence or very early talkies coming out of the silence, and 1930. Mm. And this is one of the few people to actually make the transition and then to throw in the towel almost immediately afterwards was Garbo. Garbo was a silent star. And then as soon as she showed up in the talkies, oh, my gosh, she was even more popular. You know, I want to be alone. Oh, my gosh. So, so amazing. And this is such a beautiful, and she switched up her game. She changed her her acting style and was able to make that transition. And Anna Christie shows you exactly how. It is a wonderful, wonderful movie. Maybe I'd almost go so far as to say the best pre-code sound film that there is.
Yeah, Frances Marion from the Eugene O'Neill is just really, really great. I'm a big fan of Frances Marion.
I am too.
As an actress and as a writer, we sometimes forget about these women. These women were doing things, man. They were amazing.
Yeah, they were. Got a few here that don't really warrant too much discussion. We got Madame Bovary with James Mason and Jennifer Jones and Van Heflin, Louis Jourdan. It's an all-star deal directed by Vincent Minnelli. It doesn't really hew that closely to the book. I mean, it nominally does. You're really watching just a splashy Vincent Minnelli period film, beautifully shot, nicely staged with a lot of stars. you know, so if you want a more accurate Madame Bovary, probably watch the Claude Chabrol film. Mm. But this one is perfectly fine. Jennifer Jones is, you know, lovely. Tarzan the Ape Man with Johnny Weissmuller is just ridiculous.
What are you gonna do?
Horrible movie. It's nothing at all like the book, but Weissmuller was a you know, star athlete, and he was showing up in the movies, and they put him in a skin outfit, and it's a ridiculous movie. It's ridiculous, but it is historic, so I guess it's worth something.
That's the one from 32.
Yeah.
The Van Dyke film, the W.S. Yeah. Van Dyke. Okay, yeah.
It's absurd. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Lionel Barrymore and the Devil Doll. This has been showing up over and over for the last 30 years on DVD and now Blu-ray. It's always looked terrible because it was always public yeah. domain transfer.
Yeah.
This is taken from Archival Elements at Warner Brothers. It's okay. It's not... I just don't know if it could look any better. Todd Browning directed it, so it's perfectly fine. I don't think it's a very good movie, but co-written by Eric von Stroheim.
Yeah, some
weird. Todd Browning directed a Stroheim script.
Yeah,
how do you feel about that?
That is crazy. That's just so, you know.
Katharine Hepburn in Christopher Strong, a movie I had completely forgotten existed. She's super young here. This is from 1933.
Fantastic, but, though. Yeah,
it's really lovely.
Dorothy Arzner again. These women.
I know.
Dorothy, one of Hollywood's, you know, one of the preeminent directors. Was she still teaching? No, she's down at USC where Ray went to school. She wasn't at UCLA, right, Dorothy? Yeah, she taught at USC.
I can't remember. But
yeah,
it should have had a longer, stronger career.
Yeah,
really. Yeah, really a lovely, lovely director. And, you know, people, it kind of blows people away. They're like, wow, 1933, a major feature film with a major star directed by a woman. Yeah. Yeah, there were a few of them and they just didn't get the chances they should have had. But this is rock solid, great RKO film. Katharine Hepburn is perfectly lovely in Christopher Strong, which is, you know, a kind of a feminist film in the
30s. It's about a famous female flyer. Now that was the thing in the 30s. There were lots of famous female flyers in the 30s, which is weird because we're in 2024. I cannot name one famous female flyer.
It's true.
But yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, there it is. Gene Simmons and Robert Mitchum in Angel Face from 1952, which, you know, I'm perfectly fine. Otto Preminger did just about everything in his career, and this is one that doesn't feel fully Preminger, but it has some dark edges to it that I guess reflect his sensibilities. That's another good one. Just two more. Errol Flynn and Alexa Smith in Gentleman Jim, directed by Raoul Walsh in 1942, right in the middle of the war. It takes place in San Francisco, the 1880s. It's all about Gentleman Jim Corbett, the famous boxer. Mm. Errol Flynn does a pretty decent job, honestly. He's not usually like a biopic-y guy, but you know what? He really kind of sells it. He makes you forget that he's Errol Flynn for a bit. And
Both the skipper and Fred Mertz are in that movie.
That's right. Alan Hale is in it, and
William Frawley.
And of course, they had done Robin Hood together.
Together, yeah.
Yeah, so that's fun, and it's an interesting life. And then the last one here is Wichita with Joel McRae. The one color film this week from 1955. I am not a Joel McRae fan. Joel McRae, and you and I have talked about this, Joel McRae is one of those actors from that period who got work only because the other five guys passed on
him. Yes.
He was like your fifth option. He's like, oh, well, let's see. Gary Cooper passed and Errol Flynn passed.
Lancaster available.
So, all right, well, we're down to Joel McRae.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. What about Van Heflin? Is Heflin around?
Yeah, Van Heflin's
no.
Exactly.
Okay. But
you know, another one of these European directors kind of doing something he's not necessarily suited to, but doing a decent job. Jacques Tourneur.
Yeah.
Not really his thing. It's a Western. It's color, but somehow he makes it all work. And you know, here Joel McRae basically is, you know, playing Wyatt Earp and not even remotely convincing as Wyatt Earp, but it's fine. It's one of many Wyatt Earp films. Everybody's got their take, so I'll cut him some slack. Let me go through these The docs stuff real fast, because that's sitting here kind of on my periphery. Flying Boat by Dirk Braun, who apparently is a local neighbor of mine. But this is a terrific little documentary about amphibious planes, which I guess are becoming extinct. I mean, they're all kind of dying, and the people who are restoring them in this from the, where they're sitting in this Arizona boneyard, they call it, this graveyard of these planes. But, you know, this was a thing for a long time. You could take these planes to where there are no airports, where there are no landing strips.
Well, it's what Howard Hughes was doing all the time. That big old Spruce Goose, it's a fly. And it was kind of a big old thing. Even when I was in the military, these were very effective planes when I was associated with the Navy. Because, yeah, as you say, you could literally land these planes and then just sort of scoot right out.
Got a body of water, you can land.
Yep.
That's it. If it's it's a lake, it's you know, even a big wide river. You know, you could land this thing on the Mississippi, any part of the Mississippi. So I mean, the versatility of these things and where they could go really is utterly fascinating. Even snow, you could land these suckers on snow. I had no idea. So I mean, this is a really, really interesting, fascinating doc made by a guy who is a pilot, documentarian and a pilot. So he's bringing it, and a lot of good stuff going on here. So, yeah, man, Flying Boat, good documentary on DVD. We also have The Weeds, which is all about Dwayne Johnson and his fight with Monsanto. Anything about Monsanto just makes for a good documentary, because that company just they hide so much, and they are so opaque about everything that it's a challenge to a documentarian.
No, brother, I grew up in St. Louis, the headquarters of Monsanto, and it was
really like, it's in St. Louis.
Oh yeah, headquarters for Monsanto is in St. Louis. My entire childhood was always a thing. That company.
Well, anyway, this is quite a story. It is obviously one of many Monsanto stories, but. You know, it gets into that whole, they could probably do this as a narrative film too. It's about, you know, whether or not the Roundup herbicide is cancer causing, which we now know it is. In my community, it's actually banned.
And it's actually pervasive. There are Roundup is likely to land in a crop, whether you want that Roundup in that crop or not, because it's so pervasive, and it can be spread by the wind. So I put Roundup on my crops. You will have Roundup on your crops, whether you want it or not. And so it's a whole thing, man.
And a great Peace Corps documentary here, A Towering Task by Alana DeJoseph, with beautiful narration by Annette Benning, who just has that beautiful, beautiful voice. But if you don't know the story of the Peace Corps, it's quite a story. It is a really wonderful story. And whether or not you like the Peace Corps, and I know they have their critics and they have over time. But wow, it just all begins from the, you know, Kennedy's initiative in 1961, and it moves forward. And
Sergeant Shriver, right? What's like a brother-in-law or something like that?
Brother-in-law.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And it basically confronts what has happened to the Peace Corps now, because it does kind of feel lost in a lot of other NGOs at the moment. So, it does address what's going to come of it.
Yeah.
And then a couple other new films here, Concert and Steelbook. We don't have any other Concert or Steelbook titles this week, so I'm just going to throw these out there. School of Rock, 20th anniversary Steelbook, limited edition, Jack Black, hilarious, wonderful movie. They did a Broadway show out of this that was spectacular as well. And I still love this movie. I say this is Richard Linklater's best film. I know it's not his most auteur-y film, but it's a great movie.
That's because it's written by Mike White. He didn't write it. And Mike White wrote it. So that's why it feels like a film as opposed to a thought that Richard Linklater had.
That's right. But you know what? He serves the script.
Yes.
He really does. He serves the script well. And what I will say about Jack Black is a guy who can very easily take over a movie. And he has. He's big personality, big voice. He could very easily walk into a movie and just take the whole thing over. In two cases, Jack Black has taken a step back and said, I am not the most funny, interesting, or meaningful thing about this movie. I'm going to share this with the ones who are. This is one of them. The other one is Tropic Thunder, where he clearly said, this is an insane cast and I am not going to try to show any upstage anybody. I'm just going to do my thing and let everybody else do their thing. And we're going to have a blast. Here, he looks at these kids and he says, these kids are amazing. I'm going to do my thing and then I'm going to hand it off to them and I'm just going to let them take the spotlight. And he does. And it is just so good. So
yes.
If you don't already have it, get the Steelbook. It's fantastic. And then on Blu-ray, for the very first time, I don't know why it took so long, Eddie Murphy Raw. From 1987, Eddie was in his absolute prime. He was owning the box office all through the 1980s. I mean, we'd done Beverly Hills Cop and, you know, we'd done, Golden Child. What else do we have?
The 48 hours movies, another 48 hours. It
was crazy.
He was at the moment, and you know, and Richard was still around in 1987, but yeah. He was the biggest comedian in the world. This is directed by Robert Townsend, who we interviewed not too terribly long ago. I think we talked to Robert about this,
and produced by Keenan Ivory Wayans,
and produced by Keenan Ivory.
Co-written with Keenan Ivory Wayans.
It was just the whole thing, and look, Eddie, at the time, Eddie could really do no wrong. So Four Seasons, and at the time, frankly, it was just a little it's a little easier to just be funny. And there are a lot of sketches in this movie. You got Sam Jackson and Tatiana Ali and all these other these people doing sketches all through this thing, and it's just really, really, really funny.
Raw is a great concert. I mean, it is great. It's just legendary. There's not a bad joke in the whole thing, and you know, this is when those concert films, we're getting theatrical releases. I mean, now it all shows up on Netflix, but I mean, you know, they were, and Pryor is the one who sort of set the stage for that.
Pryor is
the guy who did, you know, Live on the Sunset Strip and all that stuff. And those things are showing up in movie theaters and people are buying tickets.
Went to see every one of those movies and in the theater.
And people were like, wow, you could sell tickets and you could pack theaters for concert shows. And then HBO rolled around and kind of unraveled all of that. But
what's interesting now, that exact same framework, we look at these young ladies, Taylor and Beyonce, and what are they doing?
It's what it is.
It's so circular, dude. It's just nothing is done.
No, you're right. You're right. We got TV. We got a little bit of, we got some new stuff. We got 4K. What you want to jump to next?
Let's jump over and do a little bit of TV because we haven't done that much thus far. I saw Dick Van Dyke on something.
Yeah.
Yes. Dick's still with us. I don't know if he goes back as far as Shecky.
Let me tell you something about Dick. So first of all, Dick lives in my community. Dick is a treasured member of my community. In fact, it used to be an annual event that Dick Clark, Dick Van Dyke. My head is still stuck on the Globes thing. It used to be an annual event that Dick Van Dyke would write a letter to the local papers saying, "Why can't I find any place locally where I can buy a screwdriver and some underwear?" and I've seen him driving around, and he also does a thing on Halloween, which we went to not last year, but the year before. He doesn't come out, but he hires a whole lot of like Vegas acts, you know, ventriloquists and puppeteers and, you know, impressionists. And they put on, and he has all the animatronic monsters in front of his house, and they set up a little stage and for kids to gather around, and at two different showings on Halloween, you can bring the kids in front of Dick Van Dyke's house and they can sit there, and it's like a full lineup of vaudevillians from Vegas doing their shtick for these kids. And it's amazing. And the kids love it. And it's a really fun time. So also they are the local high school is now going to name the performance center, the Dick Van Dyke Performance Hall. They're naming it after him, raising money to do that. And he has given his full endorsement and support to that. So Dick Van Dyke, a treasured member of my community, and we're very happy to have him here. And the Dick Van Dyke Show, which has been out before on Blu-ray. This is not the Blu-ray. This is now from FilmRise. FilmRise got the license and they put the complete series on DVD. And in addition to that, we have the complete series of That Girl on DVD, also from FilmRise, and the first ever Blu-ray release of the original The Odd Couple from CBS Paramount. All three of these classic sitcoms are now out in complete sets. Whether you like the Blu-ray DVD thing, that it's they're all worth buying. I mean, we haven't had the full Dick Van Dyke set out in ages, and it's wonderful to have it. And That Girl, I think, is a totally underrated show. A lot of people thought it was like a second-tier Mary Tyler Moore show.
No. Mary Tyler Moore actually built from the platform that That Girl, Marlo Thomas, and her dad, you know, Dan, they built that platform that Mary Tyler Moore, James Brooks. That's James L. Brooks, right? Mary Tyler Moore? No.
Yeah. Yeah, Mary Tyler Moore was James L. Brooks.
You look that up, people, and follow this. Danny Thomas was a freaking genius, and there are a lot of very famous people who we know better that Danny Thomas built. He built those people.
Yeah, and I think That Girl was a fantastic show. Dick Van Dyke show. Let's just say something about this for a second, because this was a Desilu production. It was Lucy and Desi getting behind a new sitcom that wound up actually achieving, if not surpassing, the heights that I Love Lucy did in its day. Mm-hmm. Dick Van Dyke show not only gave us Dick Van Dyke, gave us Mary Tyler Moore, but the whole premise of the show, he's a TV writer. Carl Reiner basically channeled all of what was originally going to be the star of his own show. And then Carl Reiner stepped back and they hired Dick Van Dyke, and Dick brought the charisma. And next thing you know, this show is up and running, and it is a wonderfully funny show. The only difference between this and I Love Lucy is that the wacky neighbor couple, that's Maury Amsterdam and
Rosemarie,
they're his work buddies. They aren't neighbors. And the front door is not next to the kitchen. It's screen left.
Yeah.
That's the only difference.
Yeah.
But my favorite thing is on the Dick Van Dyke show, my absolute favorite thing was when Jerry Van Dyke would show up and do his little guest shtick as Dick's brother. Those things just slay me. His narcoleptic dual personality Jekyll and Hyde shtick is so funny.
Mary Tyler Moore, who, while being breathtakingly beautiful, right? I mean, just in the time, breathtaking, was ridiculously funny. Her timing was every bit as sharp as all of the rest of the very famous, all those other people were already very famous comedians, yes. Rosemarie and obviously Carl and Dick too, for that matter. And Mary was like this very fresh, new thing. She was also quite a bit younger than Dick Van Dyke, but she was up to the task 100%.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, totally true. And you know, let's not sell short Ted Bessel on
that gets it.
He made me laugh every single time. That was just brilliant.
Great straight man.
And The Odd Couple now on Blu-ray. I will say this too. I have all these local stories about these people. So Jack Klugman. One year we had a local city council election here, and Jack Klugman and I was handed a list of people to call. Right, I was like, got to call these people, get them out to the polls. So I looked at the list. I'm like, holy crap, Jack Klugman is on my list. Well, it was a list of like 40 or 50 people, right? Yeah. Small town. And I'm like, I'm calling Jack Klugman for it. So I picked up the phone and I called Jack Klugman. And I'm like, I hope he picks up. I hope it's not a machine. I hope he picks up. Hello. I'm like, yes. Mr. Klugman, hi. Wade Major calling. Just want to urge you to go out and vote today at city council election. Oh, my God. Thanks. Click. Made my life, man. I talked to Jack Klugman on the phone.
That must have been the Quincy years.
It was post Quincy. It was post Quincy. This is like around 2000.
Yeah.
But you know what? Look, have we ever had a movie that successful that was turned into a TV show with different actors that became even more successful? I mean, Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau in the movie, and you replace them with the incredible choice of Tony Randall and Jack Klugman. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it worked beautifully.
And they've resurrected this show how many times?
The black one was Ron Glass, and I want to say
it was DeMont Wilson.
And I think Ron Glass.
Ron Glass.
The other one. DeMont Wilson was just, it was crazy. It's ridiculous.
I think there have been two black versions, one female version.
Yes.
And then there was wasn't just like the last year or two, didn't they try doing like a younger version?
Or yes. Version? It was like a Latino, young Latinos or something like that. It was crazy.
Anyway, it works. It works. Yeah. Come on, man. It works. It just works. It's great. Also on TV, we got The Sandman. Have you watched The Sandman?
I did watch that literally the first season of that show. It was kind of interesting. Sandman, you know, that character, sort of mythical, and we meet a whole bunch of other mythological characters and whatnot during the series. I thought it was actually kind of interesting, and I enjoyed it a little bit. Back in 2022, I think that series was The Sandman season one. Is there going to be a season two of that?
I think there will be. I mean, it's a well-liked show. I caught a few episodes. I get what they're going for. I like Tom Sturridge a lot. I really do. Especially at this age, I think he's really interesting. He plays the Master of Dreams in this thing. And it's a DC based thing. I'm not familiar with the source material.
Well, Gaiman. It's Gaiman and Goyer doing Neil Gaiman. Yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, I it kind of surprised me when Patton Oswalt shows up. You're like, oh, well, what are you? All right, didn't expect to see you on this show, but I mean, I think a second season will probably work better for me. I gotta finish this first season and get all the way through it. But it certainly has a vibe. I think it could be one of the more interesting DC adaptations on TV because it doesn't feel like the Arrowverse or any of that stuff.
Yeah. And we know we need to do some things with all of these universes, man.
We do. Babylon 5, the complete series on Blu-ray, now in a nice 100th anniversary boxed set. A lot of people kind of felt like this never got the chance to become... I mean, it ran for five seasons.
I was a big fan back in mid-90s or something like that. You know, it had a couple of different iterations.
A lot of people kind of felt like this could have been the new Star Trek. And I don't know if it really
was. Wasn't on the path for that, I don't think. But it is what it is. And I thought it was kind of cool. But it exists in that space between, I'm a big fan of these Stargate series. Series. And then Star Trek. This exists in the space sort of between. That Deep Space Nine kind of thing, because we're at Babylon, so you say like a space station, this whole thing going on, all these different people. It's very political. It's kind of cool. I dug Babylon 5.
And we, speaking of that, now that we're into space, we have Ancient Aliens season 18. I'm going to blow you away here. I think season 18 is where this show finally turns the corner. I think the first 17 seasons were just the setup for season 18. Honestly, I don't know how there's anything left to even cover on this show. I have no idea. I don't know. I don't get it. There you go. 10 episodes from season 18. This show just keeps finding stuff.
Well, what's interesting is the one thing they never find are any aliens.
Yeah.
Never find any ancient aliens. Never that doesn't them. Happen. Oh, that's crazy.
I wonder if on some distant planet they have a TV show called Ancient Earthlings.
They never find any.
They never find any. Joe Pickett season 2. If you haven't started watching Joe Pickett, that means that the title Joe Pickett doesn't work for you and you probably shouldn't watch the show. This is not a show it's for the Downton Abbey audience.
No.
Let me just explain that. Joe Pickett is exactly what it sounds like. That's a well-chosen name. This is a redneck show. And 10 episodes and not exactly my speed. It's, you know, out. It's a rural cop sheriff. It's like one of those Westerns in the modern day thing. You know, they're.
Yeah. Except for all these. This is not Yellowstone. All these people are poor.
Exactly. It's
very middle class.
For the kids, we have Best Birthday Ever, which is an animated thing that I am completely unfamiliar with. It's apparently a European deal, right? Based on a book series by someone named Rotrout Suzanne Berner. So from the publisher named Karlchen, I'm going to just right out of there. This feels very German to me. It's like little kind of rabbity people. They're a little bit too human to be rabbits, and they're a little bit too rabbity to be humans. That kind of thing usually creeps Tim out.
But no, deeply. Me out.
I'm going to say right now, Tim, I understand why you get creeped out. This animation is creepy to me.
It's so weird. It's so creepy. It's so good. Jennifer Saunders doing a voice. Yeah. Jennifer Saunders is everywhere now. But yes, the animation is just no.
It's just a little bit creepy. Let me just show you something. You see that face right there? Can you see that?
Oh yeah.
See that face?
With that little
look at that nose.
That nose.
Don't have noses.
No. That's a dude's nose.
Wrong. And then you see here like five fingers? What are you kidding? Like, yeah. I'm creeped out.
Opposable thumbs on the rabbit man.
I can't work with that. And then lastly, on the TV front, we got a whole bunch of Ultraman stuff.
Oh my gosh.
We've got the 55th anniversary of Ultraman, the Ultra 7 anthology, which is the 55 best episodes and specials of Ultraman. 27 hours from all these different shows, Ultraman 80 and Ultraman Taro and Ultraman Ultra 7X and Ultraman Ginga. And you realize, holy cow, there are like a dozen different Ultraman series over the years. You lose track of them. It's just crazy. So they went and chose the 55 best. I don't know what the standard is, but they put them all together. This is a great sampler, I guess, anything else. And then we also have Ultraman Battle Kaiju series number 2, which is Ultraman versus Alien Baltan. This is 2 movies and 11 episodes of Ultraman fighting something which looks like a cross between, it's a person in a suit, probably a woman judging from the shape of the suit, but basically looks like a lobster crossed with a rooster. Tim, what do you think?
Perhaps eaten by the alien from Predator.
Well, it's the strangest looking thing I've ever seen. Anyway, I guess if you're into Ultraman fighting kaijus, there's you. That's
oh my gosh.
That's your deal. So let's see. We got new movies. We got 4. Oh, Criterion. Let's hit a few Criterion real fast.
Yeah, let's do some of that.
Did you ever see the Red Balloon when you were a kid?
Oh, goodness gracious. Yes. They showed it actually in
school?
Grade schools. I remember that. Yeah. All the time. Yeah.
I did too. I was wondering if that was just a weird California thing or not. Yeah. So you get the Red Balloon here along with a bunch of other 5 other films by Albert Lamoureux, who is the filmmaker behind the classic Red Balloon, all made between the early 50s and the mid 60s. This is nearly 5 hours of stuff here. It's a pretty well packed double Blu-ray set, and you get the Red Balloon along with Bim the Little Donkey, Stowaway in the Sky, White Mane, and Circus Angel. The only other one here that is kind of classic is White Mane. White Mane is really quite lovely. But here's the thing and there's a lot of extras on here. Wonderful interviews with Pascal Lamoureux and the director's son, documentary with Lamoureux and his daughter. I mean, a lot of great stuff from French television. So I mean, there's a lot here to contextualize all this. But here's what I remember from the Red Balloon as a kid. I remember watching in class, and there's a scene where the other little kids are picking on him, and they grab him and wrestle him to the ground or pick him up, and it's a crotch move, right? It's like they get their arms right through his legs, and, it's not something that we as adults would necessarily consider humorous, but yeah. I remember the third grade or whatever age I was at the time. Oh my gosh, all the boys in the class they were inconsolable. They grabbed him in his wiener. And it was just it was nonstop, all that stuff. And that's what I still remember of that film today. I'm traumatized by it.
Oh my gosh.
That's so Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which won the Academy Award in a 4K Blu-ray combo set.
I like that movie.
What, you know, give me your thoughts on it.
Cause I never cared for that. I did not care for that movie. For one thing, it's not our Pinocchio. The narrative is different. It has this whole portion of it that begins before our Pinocchio begins. It's also, at the end of the day, the title is correct. Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, because this is a Guillermo del Toro movie. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's set in that fascist world of the Spanish Civil War that many of his movies have been in and about, and that's what this movie is about, and it has a whole lot of stuff going on, and it just doesn't have anything to do with Walt Disney's Pinocchio.
It is incredibly well animated, I have to say. I find the animation really compelling. I do wrestle with a lot of the same issues that it kind of comes at you sideways, and you sort of need to know where he's coming from and what he has done with the narrative. Still not sure what I feel about it, but I do think the animation is very, very impressive, and I love the Alexandre Desplat score. I mean, the scores have become a little bit generic over the last few years, but he suspends that here and kind of gives us something very unique and special. I was also surprised by the there's a really interesting panel on here that includes not only Del Toro but a bunch of his technicians, including Desplat, and the moderator of this panel is none other than James Cameron.
Mm. Interesting.
And you're like, all right, well, okay. I didn't know Cameron was, you know, doing that, but good on you. And he does a really good job of it. Cameron is he gets into the nitty gritty that only a Cameron would get into. Like, clearly he's asking questions about the things that he's curious about. And you're like, I would never have thought of that. Mm. So it's very instructive. It's really, really good. So the 4K is spectacular, especially for this animation. So, you know, reservations notwithstanding, highly, highly recommended.
Yeah.
And then a Blu-ray director approved of Alan Barron's Blast of Silence from 1961. This doesn't have a ton of special features on it. It's got a little making of featurette and some stills and a trailer, and that's kind of it. But an amazing screenplay here, and very, very well directed. This is this is one of those low budget noirs from the late 50s, early 60s period.
Yeah,
a short film, 77 minutes, but it really shows you where things are about to pivot from the 50s and into the 60s, into these grittier films, which dovetails into everything from blaxploitation to Dirty Harry and all these things that we get in the 70s, Serpico, all of that. You kind of see the seeds of all of that in this film. And it's basically a hitman movie. It's a hitman on Christmas. And that's it.
Oh, yeah, dude. I love this movie. Waldo Salt, co-writing. He's Serpico.
Didn't get a credit because he was blacklisted.
Because he was blacklisted back in the day. But we know he's Serpico. He's Midnight Cowboy. He's Coming Home.
Yeah.
That's right. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a really tough, gritty movie. 1961, entering the 60s, giving you a whole different vibe, and black and white. It is 1961 in black and white, which you don't often see. So pretty terrific movie. Well done, Criterion. Good job. Four Ks?
Yeah.
All right. So I don't know why. Maybe you can tell me why. I got it right on the top here. Man in the Iron Mask. Why is this on 4K?
Yeah, hey, we're talking about the Leo, the Randall Wallace film with Leo and all that kind of stuff. There you go. I mean, why is it on 4K? This is a fairly young Leo movie. Jeremy Irons, John Malkovich, all these guys. Why is it on 4K?
Now it is a Shout Select release. Shout Select. I get why it would be a Shout Select. Has kind of a cult following. Has a great cast. I'm not a fan of the movie personally. Randall Wallace wrote and directed this. Randall Wallace, who wrote, Braveheart, won an Oscar for it and pushed it to Best Picture. I get it. It's one of Randall Wallace's period things. I just didn't particularly care for this film. It's a beautiful new transfer from the original negative. 4K looks great. Audio commentary with Randall Wallace is fantastic. I get why this would be a Shout Select title. Depardieu, Gabriel Byrne, Malkovich, Jeremy Irons, Leo DiCaprio, classic original material, Alexandre Dumas. But 4K? I don't know.
The thing about this film is it's a star-studded, but this film didn't have much of a scale to it. Great costumes, nice sets, yeah. but it didn't take up space, cinematic space, in the way that, say, Braveheart or some of the other films around this period did. They really didn't. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. It doesn't elevate the novel, because the novel has some certainly intimate stuff to it, but it doesn't feel epic. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. Mm. Pet Sematary Bloodlines.
They keep making Pet Sematary movies.
They do, and I guess there's an audience for 4K with the people who like kind of higher end horror. I don't know. This is a prequel to Pet Sematary. It takes place in 1969. It's kind of all the same stuff. I like the original film.
Oh yeah,
the '80s a lot better.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess it's straight to video. I guess there's an audience for it, not necessarily mine. Here I'm going to say Shout Select made absolutely a spot on call. 4K, big old beautiful 3-disc boxed set for JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK. Mm. Wow, is this awesome. And I'm not even that big of a fan of the movie.
Yeah, but the box set is fantastic.
Oh
yeah.
My gosh, all the stuff on here. I mean, it's pretty great. You get the director's cut. Most importantly, fantastic new scan of it. Dolby Vision audio picture and Dolby audio, DTS audio. It's fantastic. I mean, it just kills it. And then on disc 2, you get a Blu-ray of the director's cut. Disc 3 is the theatrical cut. Disc 4 is special features. And boy, are there a ton of them. So, but the director's cut, really, I still think is the better film here. And the original was, the theatrical cut was already pretty long, but the director's cut really feels less. And tell me if you agree with this. It feels, the theatrical cut felt more like a conspiracy theory. Mm. The director's cut feels like, I think you got something there.
Mm. Yeah. A little bit more historical, as opposed to like, what was that movie that he made not long after that? The one with Woody and
oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, the one, yeah. Not California, but the other one. Yes. Which was like this whole sort of like notion again about these things, as opposed to the director's, which is like, we're going to try to lay out some history here, as best as we can anyway.
Well, anyway, Shout gave us a big old gnarly 4K Ultra HD set of JFK, and good on them for it. You, who are much more in touch with the younger generation, I can't believe I'm even saying that. Screwball. So you are going to have to explain to me the 4K Ultra HD Night Shift edition of Five Nights at Freddy's.
Now I got to tell you, dude, that for one thing. This is based on a video game, of course, so there's the whole thing there. But right before this came out, or maybe, I don't know, 6 months before this came out, there was this really neat movie with Nicolas Cage that came out, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same exact movie. You know, this one, you know, there's this place called Freddy's. It's this child's place, and you got to get in there with Five Nights at Freddy's, this whole thing. Now, look, if you play that game and you're of a certain age, I suppose all of this is really, really funny. It's and sort of creepy or whatever. Mm-hmm. But all I'm thinking is this would be way better if Nick Cage was in it. When they made it last year. So, you know, but I guess the kids who watched the movie kind of addicted. The animatronic, they come alive, and he's got to get his little sister back from this place. It's the whole thing. It's ridiculous.
Well, there it is. Five Nights at Freddy. Shout Select, really killing it with the 4Ks this week. Clue. That was one I didn't see coming. And, you know, I remember, do you remember how the whole deal with Clue was? They released it theatrically. Mm. With different endings.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could go see this movie several times and not see the same ending. Mm-hmm. That I thought was pretty great. Three different endings. So they include all the different endings here. So you don't have to go buy the disc multiple times. Jonathan Lynn, really good director, terrific director. My Cousin Vinny, mm-hmm. among many other great films, was the, wrote this with John Landis, brings a lot of, you know, cred, and then directed it. And I really think the movie feels better today than it did then. At the time, I thought it was kind of gimmicky. I looked at the cast. I'm like, it's based on a game. I get what you're doing. I was really cynical about it. Now there's kind of a nostalgia.
It was kind of fun, you know, the game is everything. And not for nothing, all of these people. Madeline Kahn is in this thing, and she's hysterical in this film. And Tim Curry and all. Yeah, it's just really, the cast is really just something else.
Tim Curry, Christopher Lloyd, Martin Mull, Michael McKean, Leslie Ann Warren, Eileen Brennan. You know, it really, I mean, it's a hell of a cast.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah.
And a lot of very funny people. I mean, just Martin Mull and Madeline Kahn alone would have been enough for me. So, you know, throw the rest of them in there. It's a lot of fun. It really is a lot of fun. So this movie I'm really warmed to it. And John Morris wrote the score. John Morris, who did all those Mel Brooks movies. It's a wonderful score.
Yeah.
You are also a big fan of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, I believe.
Yeah, I am. I am. Most Mutant Ninja Turtles stuff over the past, you know, 40 years, the early cartoons, fine. Yeah. And then they decided, okay, we got ourselves a franchise, and they started doing all these things. I remember doing the junket for the first live action one way back in the 90s. And these movies have really just been a mess ever since, including a live action one that they did not too terribly long ago. This is really, really good. For one thing, they're teenagers. The actual actors who are doing the voices are these teenagers. And I really dig the animation here too. It's really striking animation. It's animation. It's not trying to be super 3D animation. It's mostly sort of like 2D, sort of flat, but very scratchy and very urban and very gritty. It's more like a Frank Miller Sin City kind of thing than it is some big fancy, you know.
And see, we were all swapping emails and awards time, and I'm like, oh, what do you like for animation? You know, we're all asking each other. I'm like, because I'm going for all the, you know, I don't want to vote for anime again. I'm tired. Like, Boy and the Heron, really? Is that what it's going to come down to? Like, what about Azume? What about, well, does anybody see Migration? I don't want to vote for a Pixar. Was there any Pixar this year? What about Illumination? They got Migration. And all the Spider-Man movie is Spider. Yeah, it was a Spider-Verse. We already done that.
Yeah.
And then you came out of the blue and said, TMNT, Mutant Mayhem. And I was like, what? Okay. And I went and I checked it out. Son of a gun, you were right.
It's so much fun.
It's the look. It's the style. They did here what I thought the Spider-Verse movies were also doing, which was finding a still aesthetic, a comic book aesthetic, an art aesthetic, maybe even kind of a graffiti aesthetic, and saying, let's adapt that to animation. We don't have to, like, 2D animation and 3D animation don't have to be these totally separate categories. We can split the difference now. We can use CG technology and 2D aesthetic, and we can find all these other looks in books, in art, on the wall of a mural. We can find this, and we can somehow create an animated aesthetic that splits the difference and goes there. Computers let us do that now.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Spider-Verse did. And I thought this took it another step.
Yep. I really just appreciate it. So yeah, got that franchise back for me. Thank you very much.
We are past Christmas, but Love Actually also came out with a 4K Ultra HD. I am one of the handful of people that defends this movie. You could tie me to a stake and light me on fire. I will not reject this movie. This is such a fun movie. I laugh at it every year. I can't get enough of it. And I especially enjoy watching the young Hugh Grant here versus the older Hugh Grant that plays the Oompa Loompa in Wonka. It's a wonderful contrast during the holidays. But Love Actually is great. Nothing new here by way of the extras. It's just that the movie's on 4K and it's just gorgeous.
Richard Curtis. Oh, yeah. We lost him not too long ago, Richard.
No, Curtis is still around.
Is Curtis still around? I must be thinking somebody else.
No, Curtis is still around.
Still good. Yeah.
Oh, thank goodness. You scared me for a second.
Yeah.
The Exorcist Believer.
No.
Yeah. They went and they made poor Ellen and poor Linda come back for this.
Yeah, this is David Gordon Green, man. That guy's career is just bizarre to me.
Gosh, I cannot for the life of me figure it out. I feel badly because George Washington was such a good debut film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somewhere somebody convinced him that he was not going to have a career doing that. And they got him off onto bad comedies and bad horror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's been doing since.
Yeah. Yep. He did all kinds of wacky jokes and all that goofy stuff. And then I guess he had his finger in the resurrection of the Halloween films there for a while, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And now he's over here messing around with this, and I just don't get it. And Lamar Odom Jr. And I guess
Leslie.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Lamar, have you on my thing? Yeah. Leslie, thank you. I suppose if you think of this in terms of being a sort of serious, elevated horror film, as I suppose the first one was 50 years ago, but it just doesn't live in that space anymore. You know, all that space is occupied now by the Conjurings and the.
I feel so badly for Ellen Burstyn because she's, you know, they drag her out and make her play this, the older version of her original character. And it just feels like it's just undignified, and we didn't need this movie.
Yeah,
we didn't need it. And then the last 4K here is Varsity Blues 25th anniversary, first time on 4K. I know this movie has kind of a cult following.
Football heads love this stuff. This Friday Night Lights, they love this stuff.
I mean, it was never my thing, but I've grown to kind, because I know enough people who really love Friday Night Lights and really love Varsity Blues. And I kind of understand where they're coming from, because for a certain part of the country, this movie is their experience.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happened. This is it. This was it. I didn't go to a single football game when I was in high school. Ever. Mm-hmm. I ditched pep rallies so I could go and see movies, right? Like pep rallies, go out. Well, let's just go to Westwood and see a movie. Then you sneak out, right?
Yeah.
And so that was my thing. I wanted nothing to do with it at the time. But you know, John Voight, man, he's really good. And there is something here. There is something here. So I get it. You know, Scott Conn is really good.
This was that moment when I thought, you know, that Brian Robbins is the director of this film. He's an actor. He's an actor who was if you go look up Brian, you'll know his face immediately because you were watching him in sitcoms all through the 80s. And Brian frankly made a whole lot of bad movies. Dave, but Eddie Murphy. I mean, but every now and again, Brian would knock one out of the park. But plainly, he was a very ahead of the class. That was that.
Ahead of the class.
And produced some big movies. Produced Norbit. Him and Eddie had this thing. Coach Carter, the stuff. And I don't know. He's a bright guy, very very capable, because he worked his way up from being a fairly bad sitcom teen actor, because Brian was not good at that either. Worked a lot to being a fairly noted director in television and then in feature films, and now running a freaking studio, dude. I mean, that's almost that Brandon Tartikoff kind of story that you used to hear about, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. But there he is, Brian Robbins.
Yeah,
and he's our age, and you know, I'm talking about him, like, you know, but there he is.
Yeah, well, it's somewhere in his wicked childhood, he must have done something good. Let's hit a few of the new movies in the limited time we have left. The first of the Oscar-y nominated-y stuff is out, and it is The Holdovers by Alexander Payne, my old classmate, making a huge comeback after that little miniaturization movie that he
downsizing did. And all that kind of
downsizing. Yeah, that was a disaster. You know what? He just got himself another DGA nomination, man, with this, and I think this is an amazing movie.
Yeah, yeah. And beautifully, what he did is he got Paul Giamatti and Dave Vine, Joy Randolph Golden Globes.
Yep.
So, you know, good that he did something for them, even more than for himself.
Absolutely. I mean, for those who don't know, the whole marketing of this thing, from the trailer all the way to the soundtrack and to the whole style of the movie, is that it evokes those kind of dramedy commas of the, like a Mike Nichols film from the early 70s. So it wants to look, even the palette of the colors is the early 70s. And the opening, the copyright, I think they even have a phony copyright bug during the opening titles that says 1971 on it. I have to take a look at it again. But it's, I mean, it's a great movie. It's a great movie. It's all about an elite prep school back east in the early 70s and the people who are stuck at school when everybody else gets to go home for the holidays. And Paul Giamatti is the teacher who has to stay there and babysit all these people. And this one kid in particular who thought he was going to be, you know, going home, and turns out he's not, because his mom and her new boyfriend are going to instead go on vacation. So he's stuck. And Divine Joy Randolph, who was so freaking amazing on Netflix with Eddie Murphy in Dolomite,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, she was so good in that. Total, complete reinvention. I mean, if you saw her in that and you see her in this, you would never imagine it's the same actress.
Yeah, man.
She was so broad and so funny. Here, she takes it all the way down. It is minimalist acting, the kind of that my father loved. My father would have loved her performance in this. And she's the woman who basically, you know, she works the kitchen at the school. And her, I won't give anything away, but there's a tragedy that she's party to. And she is a big player in the lives of these other characters. And, you know, she just holds it all in until this one moment of the film, and oh my gosh, then it just blows up. It is so brilliant.
Yeah.
Really, it may be my favorite performance of 2023, what she does here. It's just so extraordinary. But I love this movie. Alexander Payne did not write it. He's working with a separate screenplay by David Hemmingson for a change. Mm-hmm. So, you know, normally he co-writes these things, not here. And son of a gun, Mark Johnson, you know, another great producer after all the way back to Rain Man and all those great Barry Levinson movies. Mark Johnson, who runs the foreign language or the international film committee now for the Academy. He another great producer. So The Holdovers is for real, and you got to watch it. It's just great. Few other newish films here. Padre Pio. Did you see Padre Pio?
I did not see that one. Padre Pio.
With Shia LaBeouf.
No.
By Abel Ferrara.
Oh, Shia and Abel doing the thing. I wish I'd seen that. I didn't see that.
This is a movie about an actual individual named Padre Pio, a kind of a legendary monk. This is all kind of around the end of the First World War, and this is the movie that led Shia LaBeouf to overcome all of his demons and convert to Catholicism. Playing this character, researching this character, he converted to Catholicism.
Okay.
Craziest thing in the world. I know. Like, yeah. I wonder if Abel Ferrara was like, dude, I think it's taking a little too far.
Shia has all kinds of issues, but nevertheless, he has always been, though, a really good actor. I've always said that about him.
I don't like this movie. I will just say that I don't like this movie, but it's a weird movie that I think some people will like. So I'm going to try to be fair to it in this sense. What's odd about this movie is it's two totally disconnected stories taking place at the same time that have nothing to do with each other. And I don't really understand why they're slapped together. There's the very tortuous experience of Padre Pio himself, who is just, you know, he's miserable and he screams and he hates himself and he's just trying so hard to get over issues. And then there's a whole thing that's taken place in a small town, this political stuff in Italy. I'm sure in Abel's mind something ties those things together, but it doesn't really work in the context of the film. It's very frustrating. But maybe for somebody else that'll all work. I will leave it to you and try to be fair. Strays, featuring the voices of Will Ferrell and Jamie Foxx as dogs.
Yeah.
This is the Unleashed edition. I don't know, Tim. I talking dog movies.
No, I'm not doing that. I am not doing that. And this is one of the ones, because the technology is a little fancy now, so they can try to make the dog's mouths snots.
Babe.
Yeah, you know, and it's not, it's no better now than it was then. The dog isn't talking. So cut it out.
Yeah, I mean, this is produced by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who, of course, you know, everything from the the freaking Lego movies and all the Jump Street, right? I mean, I don't know. Anyway, all right, you know, knock yourself. If you like the actors, I guess you could put up with it. Woody Harrelson in Champions, a Bobby Farrelly movie that is not as good as the last one that won him Best Picture. But I guess there's something to this. I'm trying to Woody Harrelson and sports films, and Ernie Hudson is in this, and he's wonderful. And there's a lot to like in this, and the whole underdog story about the basketball coach, and he's coaching people who have disabilities, and it's really sweet and meaningful. I just don't know that it all works. It still feels a little saccharine.
Mostly it made me uncomfortable. and all I know is that's not my fault. If I'm uncomfortable, it's not my fault. That's the filmmaker's fault. And that's what that movie did. And it really has nothing to do about the people and their disability. It's just the way it's shaped.
I think you're right. 1001, the A.V. Rockwell movie with Tiana Taylor. Man, this thing was it won Sundance and was expected to be an awards contender. I watched it. I think it's terrific. It's a very Sundance-y film, but man, this thing just fell out of the conversation during awards season. And I'm not quite sure why.
Me either. There were a few along these lines to just and it was right there. She's great in this movie, and she was also in White Men Can't Jump, the remake of that. And I didn't. But here and this movie is just sort of I just really felt it. But it just sort of slipped out of the conversation.
It's about a single mom and her 6-year-old kid, and just trying to keep him out of the foster care system, it's a love story about a mom and a son, you can't help but just really feel it. And I thought Rockwell just killed it, but somehow it just, I guess too many other movies. Did you see Showdown at the Grand?
I don't think I saw that one.
So, yeah, John Savage, Terrence Howard, Dolph Lundgren looking utterly ridiculous. Dolph Lundgren looking like some kind of heavy metal guy. I don't know what the idea is there. This is another one of those strange movies that some very talented people probably thought was going to wind up being better than it was. Written and directed by somebody I've never heard of named Orson Oblowitz.
Yeah.
Anyway. So I think this is another one of those things that wants to be a Tarantino film, but can't quite figure out what a Tarantino film is. Terrence Howard is a total Tarantino construct in this thing. He owns a movie theater. He loves movies. And, then suddenly his livelihood is put at risk by a bunch of developers. And next thing you know, he has to turn into a Tarantino character, a different kind of Tarantino character, to hold his own and stave them off. Man, it just, but it doesn't, it never quite like gets there, right? It never, never gets over it. And Dolph Lundgren is just utterly ridiculous. Completely ridiculous. His most misguided wig I've ever seen.
Where do people get the money to make these movies?
You know, I wish I knew.
That's got to be a $13-15 million dollars.
It looks like it. It looks like it's at least 10. It is an easy 10, like a soft 10, just to pay your
cast. Yeah.
Absolutely. A movie here that I'm only going to recommend for one reason. I'm just going to say, first of all, this movie is called A Sunday Horse. It's based on a true story. About a young woman who has a very promising career riding horses, and then tragedy strikes and all this kind of stuff, you know, and then it's all set around the national jumping championships and so forth. Look, Cassie Thompson, lovely young actress, even sticking Linda Hamilton in this thing wouldn't normally make me recommend it. Even sticking Ving Rhames in this thing wouldn't make me recommend it. But once you put William Shatner
in this movie,
it's the Shat. You got to see it. Because the Shat loves horses. And that's all they need to do is somebody went to his agent and said, we're making a horse movie. Well, yes.
Yeah.
That was awful. He's 91 years old now. He'll do anything. But anyway, yes, I will recommend the The Holdovers, Sunday Horse. I don't even remember the title. I don't care. Watch Sunday Horse because Shatner's in it.
It was actually kind of moving, you know. So it's the whole program. Shatner kind of moving.
Let's see here real quickly. Just going to knock off three, maybe four more. Here we go. I got just a few more. John Travolta and Stephen Dorff are in a movie called Mobland.
Oh, I saw that movie.
What did you think of it?
Actually, that movie comes together fairly nicely. Now, this is the kind of movie that, you know, 30
only
years.
Only on DVD, not on Blu-ray.
The movie comes together fairly nicely. John is the sheriff, and it's all set in the sort of Mississippi Delta slop. Nothing in these NASCAR racing is the thing. You got this guy, and yes, his wife and his goofy brother-in-law, played by that Dylan kid, not Kevin Dylan.
Yeah,
gets him involved in another thing, and it all goes bad. Somebody gets killed, and the next thing you know, this guy has a hitman on his tail, played by Stephen Dorff. And Stephen Dorff is just kind of doing that thing that he's been doing for a while. But John Travolta in this movie is kind of neat. He's playing this sheriff, and he's kind of. Oh, he's kind of McClouding the whole thing, you know, that whole thing. But he's a lot savvier than he seems to be. And as this movie, sort of brutal little movie, as a matter of fact, sort of wraps itself up, John Travolta is the guy who's figured it all out. And he makes sure that everybody pays their bill. At the end of that movie, and frankly, it came together very nicely. It made sense. I loved it. It was set in the mud and muck of Mississippi, and everybody looked and sounded like they were right from where they were from.
Kind of okay. Well, there we go. Yeah. There we go. And then a little kind of British-y romantic comedy called What's Love Got to Do With It, starring Lily James and Emma Thompson and Shabana Azmi, the wonderful Indian actress, and Shahzad Latif. This is just a great little working title produced British romantic comedy that is perfectly endearing. I don't know why this did it. It has nothing to do with the American What's Love.
No, nothing to do with Tina Turner.
I don't even know why they use that title. They should have used a different title because that just makes no sense. I'm sure there should have been a problem. But anyway, I love everybody in this thing. And I'm watching, I'm thinking, this is just a totally charming little cross-cultural romantic comedy. The whole vibe about, Indians and Indian families in England, and, you know, the Prime Minister of England right now is of Indian extraction. And there's a whole history there, right, that is culturally really very interesting, especially in this point in time. And this goes there. And I love Shabana Azmi. I've met her at press junkets. And this is just, I thought this was a really sweet film. And then I look and gosh, it's directed by Shekhar Kapoor. Where's he been? You know, he was directing all these big epics for the longest time, you know, Elizabeth and Feathers, and he vanished. He was supposed to do Tale of Two Cities with Mel Gibson, and that never happened. And then he got bitter, and I thought he went back to India. No, he made this, and good on him.
Yeah. Sweet. Makes a sweet little movie that's actually good.
It's good.
Nothing wrong with it.
A few more here. About My Father with Robert De Niro and Sebastian Maniscalco. Robert De Niro just playing disgusting, wacky old guys.
Again.
He did
one with that other kid. The kids from High School Musical. The grandfather or something like that.
My filthy old disgusting grandfather, whatever that was.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm kind of tired of it. I'm sort of tired of it, but I guess they keep paying him and it's the only gig he keeps getting. Anyway, I was just happy to see Kim Cattrall here. Nonetheless, it's getting a little old.
Oh, I guess nobody, literally, there are no likable characters. No. Leslie Bibb is in it. But there are no likable men in this movie. The father sucks, the son sucks, all these people are terrible. Awful. And I get it. There's a kind of, they're doing this whole kind of, Italian, but I'm like, I know a lot of Italian men. They're nice.
Yeah.
They're not obnoxious at all.
And then Paw Patrol and Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, and Hotel Transylvania, Transformania, the three animated films, none of which got nominated for anything or won anything in the animation, the year-end animation bonanza. So let's talk for a second about why.
Mm.
So Paw Patrol, the mighty movie, is not getting recognized because Paw Patrol is stupid. Is it well animated? Sure, sure. I have been to so many kitty birthday parties over the last 5-6 years where it was Paw Patrol themed. I'm over it. I'm really over it. I don't like the TV show. I should give this thing more credit. I'm sure if your kids love Paw Patrol, ignore everything that I'm saying and just grab this thing. It's like, but I'm up to my eyeballs in Paw Patrol.
Oh yeah.
Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, from the studio that brought you Shrek and How to Tame Your Dragon, which means DreamWorks. So here's the problem I have with Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken. Tim, what's a kraken?
if you're not actually talking about Greek mythology, it's not anything. It's nuts. And here's the thing about that movie.
Yeah,
Ruby Gilman, she turns into this kraken, so that she can do all of the things that any teenage girl could do without turning into a kraken. So what the hell is the point? Now I can make a decision. Okay, sweetie.
See, I thought they would have looked at Pixar's turning red. And,
yeah, it's not really necessary to turn into the red thing.
Don't want to go to that place again. Maybe we should pull the plug on that idea.
Maybe you could just make a decision, sweetie. Make a decision. That's all you got to do.
But my problem is, okay, this is aimed squarely at my daughter's demo.
Okay.
Like, my daughter is what this is aimed at. I showed her the trailer. The look on her face was not even Wish, which is tanking. Disney's Wish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, ooh, I want to see that.
Yeah.
She looked at this and it was like this weird kind of expression of, I don't know what to make of that.
I don't know what that word means. And
I am very proud of the fact that we have taught her all kinds of worldly things and taken her to great places and taught her about literature and food and culture. You know what we have not taught her? What a kraken is.
What a kraken is. You don't need to know that, sweetie.
Don't need to know that. So right there, somebody at the studio should have raised their hand and said, kids aren't going to know what a kraken is. Nobody knows what a kraken is.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, Hotel Transylvania, Transformania.
No, yeah.
I'm not even sure this made it to theaters. It made a second.
It had a hot second, yeah.
I think.
Sequel to the what, 2010, 12 film?
I think this is like the third one. I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a little, monster pets short thing in it. Which I think is cute. I just think this concept has a built-in audience that you're either with it or you're not. And I guess I'm not, never have been, but
I just think that's Gendy. Yeah. Samurai Jack.
Yeah,
the creator of Samurai. And I look at all these, and he did that, at least the first one, maybe the middle one, definitely this one. And they are the exact opposite of Samurai Jack. You watch Samurai Jack, and sometimes no one would say anything. You'd see Samurai Jack walking around, and every now and again, that's Samurai Jack. And that would be all the dialogue. These movies never stop talking. They are nothing but Andy Samberg and Adam Sandler, so whoever it is, Selena Gomez in this one, and they talk constantly through this movie. It's nonstop speaking and kinetic action, and it's all super duper irritating.
I do not disagree. We still have a little bit of time, and we're over 2 hours, but I'm gonna just hit a few of these things. So let's talk about four more titles, and then we're out. So Meg Ryan and David Duchovny, What Happens Later? Meg Ryan directed this thing, and she got slammed for it. She co-wrote it. She directed it. It's based on a play, by Stephen Dietz, I guess, mm-hmm, is how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And anyway, she's kind of trying to make a comeback, put herself in a little bit more of a glamorous look, even though she's, well beyond 30 or 40, whatever she was fretting about hitting in When Harry Met Sally. Mm. I don't think it's as bad as, I don't think it's that good, but I don't think it's as bad as people. I think people want to just beat up on her a little bit. What do you think?
I agree with you completely. This is a perfectly serviceable film that 35, 40 years ago would have been, an okay little movie. It's not remotely a theatrically releasable film, but it wouldn't be no matter who made it at all. These sorts of films don't become big theatrically releasable films. But she and David have chemistry. It's a cute film. It's well made. And I just to get right down to it, I get it. Meg Ryan, our gorgeous little, from way back, she's in Top Gun, she's in The Daytime, all that kind of stuff. And now she's a 60-year-old woman. And we want to poke at that. Well, I don't poke at that. I like Meg Ryan. I like her a lot. I think that this is funny. She's a good actress. It all sort of worked for me. They're mostly sort of wandering around an airport, but it's a cool movie.
And a sweet little movie that didn't get enough attention, I don't think. The Miracle Club. Four wonderful, absolutely wonderful actresses. Three wonderful actresses and one wonderful actor. I just don't think this got enough attention. So basically, it's Laura Linney, Kathy Bates, and Maggie Smith doing that female generational thing, right? Three different women from three different generations, different backgrounds. And then Stephen Ray kind of coming in and bringing the only significant male element in that thing. But this is really interesting. They're all very close friends, and they are on their way to Lourdes, the French city with the spring and the legendary religious implications and the miracles and all of that stuff. And It really is, and there is a fourth woman, Agnes O'Casey, Laura, but she's kind of not really crucial to. Well, I shouldn't say that. That's not fair. You're watching this basically for the interplay between Laura Linney and Maggie Smith and Kathy Bates. Those are the three who are, that really kind of represent the chemistry in this thing. I'm being very careful here to kind of avoid revealing the twists in the story, but it's about more than, I think what people missed was that Lourdes is, it's not literally about women looking for a miracle. It's sort of about miracles as a metaphor in life and where that metaphor may fall at different stages of your life. And I know I'm being really kind of obtuse about this, but if you watch it, you'll understand. I think it's a very sweet film. I think it's a very smartly written film, and well directed by Thaddeus O'Sullivan, who I guess is some kind of an Irish director. I don't know. Didn't research it, but last two titles, from the stars of Duck Dynasty, The Blind, the true story of the Robertson family. We now have a biopic about the Duck Dynasty people.
Yeah.
Now, I emailed you and Ray and Mark a little while ago when I discovered that it is actually a distant cousin of mine who pioneered duck calling in the United States.
I love it.
Some major was a legendary pioneer in duck calls. So I feel suddenly like I kind of need to like this. I don't know.
I don't know. Look, no comment on the Duck Dynasty.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I guess if you're a fan, then knock yourselves out. And then Nick Cage, who makes precisely 72 movies a year.
Yeah.
In addition to the dream scenario, which I think stands a chance of getting him. It's an outside chance, but he could get another Oscar nomination for that.
Maybe so. Look, that movie, particularly because of him, got a little chit chat there. The Independent Spirit Awards is probably gonna be paying attention to him in that movie. Him in that movie. And I don't know. I hope that Academy voters will pay attention to it and see it and at least recognize Nick for that movie. I like the movie, but yeah.
Well, he stars in another movie that got no attention at all this year. And I'm a little bit surprised because it's not that terrible. It's called Butcher's Crossing. And it's one of these movies. It's a Saban film. So, I mean, they, you know, it just feeds their pipeline. But it's about buffalo hunters in the Wild West. And he's a really interesting guy here. Fred Hetchinger is the other actor who is kind of a New England guy that wants to, you know, be a little bit more of a frontiery guy. And Nick Cage plays this guy named Miller, who's this very strange, kind of quiet, reserved, just rugged buffalo guy. And it's a bit of a mismatch. Like, there's almost a 48 hours thing going on between these two. Mm-hmm. You know, the mismatched buddy cop thing, 48 hours, Lethal Weapon. You can kind of pick the movie, but it really goes into some places I didn't expect it to go, and I give them credit for that. I mean, it's a much smarter script than I thought it was when it started. So, Butcher's Crossing with Nicolas Cage, good, interesting little indie western, got no attention, but I'm gonna put a little exclamation point on it. All right, Tim, that's it for this week.
All right, baby.
We got a lot coming up. We got our Oscar show coming up. We got all kinds of stuff in the works that we haven't talked about.
This very weekend, what do we got? This LAFCA dinner.
I'm not going either.
CCA's is Sunday. I'm not going to that either. By the way, I might go to that one non-celebrity open event that the Critics' Choice is doing.
Just because last year he said it was fun.
Yeah, you know. So I don't know that, but I'm not doing the legit show room.
I'm not doing
all this stuff. So, yeah, so let's see what happens.
Too much else to deal with. Too much else to go. But with that, wish everybody well, and we will see you in a little while with another show.